This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. It's our health and living segment. Dr. George Lee in, consultant neurologist. It's Friday, of course.
Good afternoon.
Where have you been, George? You weren't here last week.
I was lost in the haze. On the way here, it just, you know, the API, the visibility was just too, you know, impossible.
And so I was typical lost. Of you, you decided to leave.
Absolutely.
You have to come back. You
absolutely.
Do realize.
I am back now. I am very excited. I've been excited all week about today.
I know, right?
Right, okay.
That is because we have a very prominent obstetrician and gynecologist in the studio with us, Professor Dr. Jamia Hassan. Welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
We finally managed to get Prof. Jamie to come here.
I know we did. It was your charm.
That's right. You know, she's so adorable. It's like, you know, all the publics will love her.
And we even got a very interesting topic to talk about today. We're discussing womb transplants. It's not something that we do in Malaysia yet, but the reason we're talking about it is because doctors in the UK have now recently granted approval to carry out the nation's first 10 womb transplants. Mm-hmm. And this is following a successful procedure in Sweden. Mm-hmm. So we're going to find out a little bit more about what a womb transplant entails and whether or not it's something that we should be considering here in Malaysia. But first of all, welcome to the show, both of you. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting.
Okay, so what did you think of the article, Professor? What did you think when you read about womb transplants? What occurred to you?
I say it's very intriguing, mind-boggling, and it's a first. But I think on the other side, it gives a chance to women who doesn't have a uterus for some reason, either they're not born with uterus or they have their uterus and been taken away from them, a chance to have a baby. But I'm sure it's not that simple. It's not just taking a womb from somebody, a transplant, and getting a pregnancy.
Yep.
But it's something that can be considered. But it's not without its own problems.
1 in 5,000 women in the UK are born without a fully formed womb. Mm-hmm. Is that a big problem here in Malaysia?
It's the same prevalence. It's about 1 in 4,500, 5,000, where we say it's Meyer-Rokitansky-Hauser-Kuster syndrome. Where
that's
the
a bit of mouthful, right?
Yeah.
What did you say?
Name.
How did you get it?
What did you say?
Meyer-Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome. Where the woman actually doesn't
this
have
no,
the
this woman knows what she's
upper
talking
vagina
about.
And uterus. So this is where they are born without them. Otherwise, they look congenitally, they look phenotypically like a female, and they have not, usually, they have normal functioning ovaries. So meaning to say, they will not have a period, or menses is what we say, but they will not have the chance to deliver their own child mm-hmm. because they don't have the uterus.
Is this some sort of developmental problems?
Yes.
That, you know, so
it is.
All right, okay. So 1 in 5,000 women, both in the West and in the East, you'll get this situation. And they don't know about it until when it comes to the menarche.
They will present to us with no period, usually. So, but they are typically female-looking, so they will not have the concern early on. So by the time they reach 17 or 16 and they have no menses, they'll come and see you. Or sometimes some women, they come before when they are married, when they cannot get a pregnancy. Mm-hmm. There are women like that, and they come to see you. They didn't bother them that they didn't have the menses early on, but they may come that stage, very late stage. But that's how they present,
that's
no
right.
menses.
And when you talk about women in without a uterus, is it can this not be detected during ultrasounds when mummy is pregnant mm-hmm. with the child? I mean, can we not detect this at that stage?
Well, that's not something we look for during ultrasound unless there is an anomaly. For example, let's say a fetus, you know, during ultrasound, we have some congenital abnormality of the kidney or we see some cystic formation in the abdomen. So one of the things we do is to check for the genitalia of the baby and to look for reproductive system. But to look for uterus in a fetus is not that easy and it's not that important to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So that's not something we routinely do.
Because it makes no difference anyway, yeah. whether you find it earlier or yes. you find it later, isn't it?
So what are the options for ladies in this country who are born, the 1 in 4 or 5,000? What are their options, really?
I guess for us to consider womb transplant in Malaysia, George, will be in another lifetime.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, the options will be you either adopt or you surrogate, right?
Yes.
And surrogacy has its, you know, problems
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, it has its problems. So in Malaysia, it's not something you want to look for, surrogacy. Or adoption, the other one.
Is surrogacy illegal in Malaysia? Not sure.
There's no clear guidelines on that, but in Muslim, definitely it's illegal.
Mm.
But now they are coming up for clear guidelines on this. We don't even have a sperm bank.
Right, okay. Yes. So that is kind of like being consolidated in a Malaysian environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, 1 in 5,000, we're not talking about very common condition.
No. But isn't that common enough, 1 in 5,000?
No, we consider it not common.
No, actually, to be honest with you, I mean, okay, right. You know, I didn't do too much of obstetric and gynecology, but I have not seen one before in my lifetime.
Okay, that's because you only saw the men.
Okay, right. All right, that's true. But I did go to medical school. I did have some exposure of obstetric gynecology.
You know, this condition can present with renal anomalies, and they might see George. But the problem is they'll see us first because of the menarche issue. And then we probably refer it to him to evaluate other things, or we find some anomalies in the kidney.
It's because of intricacy of the urinary tract, you know, the female and urinary organs, all kind of like intricacy of that.
Okay.
So whenever one breaks down and the other breaks down, that's how we all link together. But the thing is, what I want to talk about, obviously, you know, when I saw this topic, the first thing I saw your email is that is so George to talk about things, something like, it is indeed very George. But the hidden message here actually is, of course, this is a very uncommon condition, but the more common condition is young women who lose their womb because of cancer, you know, like cervical cancer and that sort of thing. And obviously that is something that you work very closely with in preventive purposes. And you know, how common is cervical cancer? How common are young women who lose their cervix and also lose their womb as a result of such cancers?
Well, cervical cancer is usually the disease of middle age. And they're not so common in young, even though you do see nowadays in younger women having cervical cancer, maybe age less than 30, or even some at the age of 20, 25, but they're not common because they're usually diseased. It takes a long time for cervical cancer.
So they're exposed in much younger age and then they pay back and later on in life.
I wouldn't say
to pay back because it's kind of like the disease actually manifests itself much later on. Kind of like
so if the sexual debut is maybe 12, 13, or 14 years old, then the chances of them getting this kind of disease be younger. But we don't see very common in our country at a younger age having cervical cancer, even though we do see now and then, but it's not common at
this
age.
It's not common, Okay, you know, obviously later on we would like to get involved the public to, you know, call in to discuss the obviously your view about, you know, transplantation of a womb and also cervical cancer, because when we have an expert here, we really would like to fully utilise her expertise.
The number to call is 0377 109 000, tweet BFM Radio or text 0162019000. Professor, you want to just go through with us what happens during a womb transplant? I mean, you get it from a deceased donor, I understand, and what happens after that?
So first, the indication, why do we do a womb transplant? One is because the woman doesn't have a uterus, and to give her a chance to conceive her own children. So you have to select patients. So patient must be healthy, because to take a womb transplant is not easy. Then after that, we've got to look at the donor. We wouldn't want a diseased uterus. Then it defeats the purpose of womb transplant.
Yep.
Because the uterus, or womb as we call it, the function is mainly one, just to house the growing fetus. And it should respond to the hormones produced by the woman. So you need a non-diseased uterus. And of course, preferably you need a young patient. But like the one in Sweden, the donor was 60 years old and the receiver was 36 years old. As long as she's healthy, the uterus can function, respond to the hormone, then it's fine.
Did you say 60?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
So the donor was 60.
The donor was 60. So would a 60-year-old wound be of any reproductive function when it's implanted into a 28-year-old?
Yeah, because I said just now, if it should respond, if it responds to the ovarian hormones, then it's fine.
Then it
got
will
to
be
respond,
fine.
Then it should function.
So there will be theoretically an awakening of a womb from the OH in response to the ovarian
because
hormones.
Even though the uterus is not functioning in a postmenopausal woman, not because it's not functioning, because it's dead. It's still alive, but because your ovaries stop producing certain key hormones, so that's why it's not shedding, and the endometrium, but the uterus is still a life organ.
Wow, how
so
amazing. I have a different viewpoint
on
this.
So actually postmenopausal women are ideal donors then?
Well, theoretically, yes, but it should not be diseased uterus. And a lot of patients can have uterus which just have disease, like, you know, having adenomyosis or having uterine fibroids and so on. So getting back to the womb transplant, so yes, that's a step. So after that, once you transfer the womb, and it involves, I can imagine, a number of surgeons to transfer it.
Right. That is a, kind of like a, you know, a complex...
An organ transplant.
Yes, it's just like an organ transplant.
Yeah.
And after that, you have to put this receiver on drugs to prevent her from rejecting the organ because it's from someone else. And her body can reject it, and then it will not be successful.
Mm.
So you have to keep it on drugs for her to not reject it. But the idea we transfer in the first place is to try and get her pregnant,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yes.
So then we have to observe. I suppose we have to observe the uterus to make sure that it's responding correctly. We have to do some tests, I suppose, to see whether it's responding to the hormones and doesn't have any problems. And now to get the patient pregnant.
Mm. So in the presence of the immunosuppressive drugs as well, and then also to see whether the new organ is taking or not.
Yes.
Wow, that just sounds awfully complex.
So women are all about hormones, isn't it?
Yeah, and so that's very complex.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you just say that? Women are all about hormones?
Yes, we are. Don't you agree from an obstetrician gynecologist?
Okay, for those of you who disagree, please call in now.
It's a medical show. Nothing to do with what
the
men...
And you say certainly. I just heard that women are all about hormone, and then I suddenly just got a glimpse of that.
Typical.
That's right.
Prof. Jamia, that means once it's successfully transplanted, mm-hmm, the woman will actually start to menstruate?
Well, if she responds to the hormones, yes, because the endometrial shedding is due to response cycle to the hormones being produced by the ovaries. So that's the idea. So if the uterus responds to that, then mm-hmm, she will have normal menstrual cycle. Then the difficulty is, I think, is to prevent her body from rejecting the uterus, this transplanted womb, and to see how far we can take her through. So if you look at the one in Sweden, there was a child born 2014 from an IVF procedure from her own eggs, and it was transplanted back into the uterus. And the next 9 months or so, or throughout pregnancy, you still got to put her on drugs to make sure she's not rejecting the uterus. And at the same time, the baby is growing inside.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to still monitor the baby and see whether or not it's having some other problem, because now it's a transplanted uterus. You're not so sure whether or not the reaction of the uterus to the normal physiological reaction of a normal pregnancy is there. So there are potential complications like the baby not growing very well and so on. So if everything goes well, so then lo and behold, you get a born child from a transplanted uterus.
Okay.
Sounds very complicated. Whole lot of risks involved.
With you unraveling all these things, I begin to get through the layers and layers of complication or complexity of this. I mean, let me get this right. First of all, obviously, there's ethical issue side of this, you know, to get someone who's either a heart-beating donor,
mm-hmm,
or a elderly live donor, which is a, mm-hmm, Swedish case, which, mm-hmm, was somebody who's postmenopausal donating a postmenopausal womb.
Why are there ethical issues, George? Well, I mean, we're doing kidney transplants.
Yeah.
We're doing all other
transplants. Yeah, well, so, you know, the thing is, I mean, we did the show, we did the show on penile transplant before. I mean, it's like, you know, apparently it is well documented now, since end of last year, there was a first penile transplant successful in South Africa that actually the recipient has fathered a child. So big news and everything. And it created a lot of issues about, first of all, you know, what happened if you have a situation where people would like just to have a new external genitalia of their liking, you know, it's like, you know, and then, you know, to transplant it, and what is the ethical issues about a sexual organ being transplanted and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's complex. I think whenever it involves a sexual organ, and also a generation that is being produced next, I think to some degree, some people raise some degree of concerns when it comes to ethical issues. What do you think?
What do you think?
That's why I say that just now patient selection is very important. So you must have clear guidelines who you transplant and what organ you transplant and for what purpose and your patient selection. And the other thing is you should also respect patient confidentiality, data confidentiality. So I think, in your case, you don't want to transplant for a sexual purpose, you know.
Mm.
So, and then like, right, for example, you want to design a baby. You want to choose this baby for
That's
this
right.
kind. So it's the same the same issue. But I think in this case, womb transplant, I don't think...
You don't think there's any ethical issues?
No, I don't. I just feel it's a whole load of complications and risks to the mother more than anything else.
Yes.
Well, in some
and discomfort,
way,
I cannot imagine.
Yeah, in some way, I agree with what you're saying because the alternative can potentially be an adoption or surrogacy, but neither of those may not be acceptable for someone who suffers from, absent wound, because it might be for religious purposes. Surrogacy may not be allowed, and also the adoption may not be a right thing for everybody. So, I agree with you that to some degree, people will think that, there is an alternative. Why go through all that complexity? So in some way, I'm thinking that just because we can in the modern technology, modern medicine, does that mean we should? So I'm quite keen to hear the public, the listeners in Klang Valley to see just because we can, to transplant a womb from either a menopausal woman or a premenopausal woman. What is proposed in UK here are heart beating, brain dead donors, right? Mm-hmm. They're proposing that in your donor card, in addition to saying the usual what you're donating, such as your heart, your liver, your kidney, and then are you willing to donate your womb as well for the purpose of, transplantation for people who are born without wombs?
Exactly. So our phone lines are open at 0377 109 000. Tweet BFM Radio or text 0162 01 9000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with us. It's Friday and we have with us also Professor Dr. Jamia Hassan, a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist. We're discussing womb transplants. I think we spoke about how it actually is carried out. Dr. George seems to think that there are ethical issues involved. What do you think? We, Prof. Jamia and I, think that, it's just a lot of risks and complications involved because, in my opinion, I don't see a difference between other organ transplantation processes and this one. It's going on, pretty much being done the same way with
as
a brain dead
any other organ.
Or donor, that sort of thing. But in Sweden, it was a 60-year-old woman who actually donated her womb for transplantation, and it was a success. The baby actually was born, and with a lot of difficulties, I'm sure, and inconveniences. We have just to go back to your HPV question, Prof. There is a question here on if a person has been found to have strains of HPV on their pap smear, but it's otherwise a normal test. Is the HPV vaccination still beneficial?
Yes, the answer is yes. The other thing is if you find strains of HPVs in your pap smear, one of the things we can do is subtype that. Because there are many subtypes, the high-risk subtype, that even so many of the high-risk subtype. Because there are the subtype that cause cancer, cervical cancer or anal cancer, but there are subtype that doesn't cause them. So if you do not have the high-risk subtype, or even if you have one high-risk subtype, for example, let's say 35 or let's say 16, you will still be protected by the vaccine from the other HPV strain, because the vaccine, like the quadrivalent vaccine, they have 16, 18, the high-risk subtypes that cause 70% of cervical cancer, that also cause more than 70% of anal and penile cancer. But the other high-risk subtypes are, 45, 52, 58, and so on, that it's not in the HPV specific. So even if you have 16, you'll still be protected by 18, and the 6 and 11 in the other strain in the HPV quadrivalent vaccine. So the answer is yes, you should still be protected.
So what you're saying is that unlike the old thinking that HPV vaccine is purely for someone who have not started their sexual debut, mm-hmm. and then nowadays that the thought is that for those people who are already exposed mm-hmm. To the virus already, mm-hmm. the vaccine will still be protective and very useful.
It's never too late, Prof. Jamia, to get vaccinated.
No, it's never so late. Because more than 70% of us who are sexually active would have been exposed to HPV. But of course, not all of us will get the persistent infection. It also depends on your immune system to sort of fight the disease. Mm. So in the younger age group, the chances are they'll be exposed. But studies have shown that it's very unlikely for them to get more than one strain more than two strains. It's highly unlikely. So the chances are you get one or even two strains is very small. And you might be exposed to the non-cancer strain HPV. Mm. So you'll still be protected from the vaccine. So the issue is, should you test yourself? Well, you can test yourself, but the testing is more expensive than the vaccine itself.
Uh-huh.
So you might as well take the vaccine.
What about postmenopausal women?
All right. Well, we've got to go by data evidence. When you look at the recommendation and look at the R&D data, the enrollment of female is from the age of 9 initially to 26 years old. Later on, they have 26 to 45 years old. Now, efficacy data from that study shows that if women from 9 to 26 years old, efficacy is more than 90%. Previously, we think the older woman will not mount an immune response.
Yes.
But data has shown that they do. So even up to the age of 45, efficacy is still more than 80%. And for genital wart in the quadrivalent vaccine in 6 and 11, efficacy is more than 90%. So it will benefit women and men together, because I think when you have a vaccine to prevent cancer, it doesn't make sense if people doesn't take it up. And people will say, oh, there's always risk the vaccine. But that goes for every vaccine.
Mm. And true, even like typhoid vaccine that people are going for, there's risk. So, I mean, why are we not? I mean, I know we're digressing a little bit away from, a womb transplant. I'm very, very excited here, because what you're saying is that it's not just benefiting women who are post-exposure to the vaccine and mm-hmm. then they're protective. We're also talking about protection for men as well.
Of course, because men are not aware that the anal cancer, oropharyngeal cancer, penile cancer is caused by the same virus, 16 and 18, and that's more than 70% are causing this anal, penile and oropharyngeal cancer. And men will benefit from this vaccine. It's not only cervical cancer, so it prevents anal cancer for both men and women. But the thing is, men also doesn't know that, the anal canal and the cervical canal histologically is the same.
Yes.
So that's how the HPV virus attacked these both areas.
Mm.
So yes, we need to vaccinate men.
Yes. And also, of course, it will reduce the risk of genital warts as
well,
right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Do you think we will ever include the boys in our national immunization program?
Well, I think in Malaysia, the burden is more of cervical cancer. So if I'm the government, I would see where I put the money on. So, of course, we would like the government to provide vaccine for both gender, male and female. But I think sometimes they got to also be prudent about it. So at the moment, cervical cancer prevention is in the female. So the 13-year-old girl in school get free HPV vaccine. So unfortunately, the boys and the catch-up girls and men have to pay for the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. It's not very cheap, is it?
Well, when you look at it, cheap is relative. So if you have the disease, it can be more expensive to treat.
Yeah, I mean, even a very, I say, simple in inverted commas, genital warts can be quite expensive to treat as well. Yeah.
And it can be lifelong. It can come back again and again. So I think vaccine is still the way to go.
Okay. And in 2007, we introduced the program. It's been, 8 years now?
So now it's the third, more than 6 years, almost 6 years. I think the uptake of the HPV vaccine, the school program, Ministry of Health, is very good. Completion of 3 doses is more than 95%, which is excellent compared to the West.
That's right. I mean, this is much higher than New York.
Even,
right?
Yes, much higher than US.
Are they still suffering from the Wakefield syndrome? in New York. Is that why the take-up isn't very
No, good? New York, no. There was some, you know, hysteria, and then there was a bit, you know reports
effects
here and there of, you know, people getting dehydrated and then a collapse and things like that. And people get worried about things like that. But the thing is that if we're talking about Malaysia that has a 90%, you know coverage, we are doing
very
extremely
good.
Well.
Fantastic. Yes. So just to come back, as a result, we're talking about cervical cancer as well and HPV because that brings about the loss of a uterus. And if you do get it in middle age, and if you, and now with women having children later and later, this could be relevant as well. So get yourself vaccinated. Up to 45 efficacy is what, 80%, you said? I'm still going for my HPV jab, George. I've not got mine because I always thought I was
old. She's suffering from the Wakefield.
No, I just felt that efficacy would be really low and it wouldn't be worth it.
And even for women who have CIN, for example, you have already some cervical disease from HPV. After treatment, now recommendation is to still take the vaccine. It will still reduce recurrence. It has been shown.
We're talking about young girl who is not exposed to sexual activity yet. We're talking
and
about
boys,
and, boys,
girls,
and boys
and
boys and of course, you know, I'm supposed to be fighting for the boys here. I left them out. Young boys and girls, or young men and women who already had been exposed, and then but not necessarily exposed to all strain of dangerous, vaccines, and then also people who actually strain of virus, and also people who women who already have got cervical cancer can also benefit from this, from prevention of recurrence
of the CIN.
Cancer. Okay. Wow. There's a question here. There are many brands of HPV vaccines. Is there a difference?
There are only two, right?
There are two HPV vaccines. The quadrivalent vaccine, when you say quadrivalent, it consists of four HPV strain vaccine, which is 16, 18 as a high-risk HPV virus that cause anal cancer, cervical cancer, and so on. But the quadrivalent vaccine has also 6 and 11. That's a low-risk HPV virus that cause genital warts. More than 90% of genital warts for both men and female are caused by HPV 16. And 11, and this is found in the quadrivalent vaccine. And the quadrivalent vaccine is the only HPV vaccine which is licensed for both female and male. But there's also a bivalent vaccine, and the bivalent vaccine only consists of HPV strain 16 and 18, and it's only licensed for female, simply because they do not have data for males. In the original cohort, there wasn't any male, and they don't have the coverage to genital warts 6 and 11. So there's only two sets of types of HPV vaccine.
Okay, so do we go and say, I want this one, I want the quadrivalent, or I want the bivalent?
Well, you have to seek coverage. I'm not working for any company, but you have to seek coverage. You want to prevent from cervical cancer, anal cancer, oropharyngeal cancer for both. But genital wart is something that also causes a lot of problems in both gender. And genital warts is caused by 6 and 11. And the reduction in genital warts with vaccine, it's tremendous. It's more than 90%. If you look at the Australian data, Australia was the first country who imposed this in the national program. And within a short time, they have shown a reduction in their patient in the STD clinic, especially to genital warts. You will not see reduction in cancer until about 10, 15 years from now, from the time you give the vaccine, because you take that long a time to develop. But you will see reduction in genital warts in countries that has the program.
Is the you were saying?
And that it will benefit the patient. It will also benefit the country into health costs.
Of course, in the long term.
Yes. Yes.
Efficacy for men, is it the same as the women?
Yes, almost the same.
Yeah. Okay, so George, you need to get vaccinated
as well. I have. I'm just thinking, you know, I'm high risk.
Don't tell everyone.
No, I don't think many people are listening. Just joking. Okay. Well, the other thing, interestingly, you know, someone mentioned that there are several brands. I know with your research and you attending so many meetings, am I right in assuming that there's another kind of like a bigger coverage of a version of vaccines coming up soon?
Yes.
In the pipeline?
That is nanovalent. Nanovalent means they have 9 HPV strain. And they're covering more than, now they're covering 2 high-risk HPV, but with the nanovalent, they're covering 7 high-risk HPV plus the low-risk 6 and 11, meaning to say we will cover more than 90% of HPV virus that's caused cervical cancer. And that particular vaccine has already been approved in the US, But it will probably come to our shore maybe in 2 years' time. I hope.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I remember when this, the association of HPV with cervical cancer kind of emerged, mm-hmm. and then subsequently the development of vaccines. And in my thought, I thought this might be something that potentially can wipe out cervical cancer in one generation. Do you think I'm over optimistic, you know, with the nanovalent, you know, vaccine coming up and that sort of thing? Can we see this horrible, horrible cancer become a disease of the past ever?
If we vaccinate enough.
Everybody.
Yes. Because you have to vaccinate both cohorts, ideally. Mm. Or if you want herd immunity, then you have to vaccinate all girls at risk and do all the catch-up risk, like what Australia is doing. Mm. So they're doing all girls, young girls, 9 to 30, and they're doing catch-up yes. until 26.
And this but is the same mistake we made with rubella, really, wasn't it? Because rubella initially was only vaccinating for the girls, and then the boys
can get rubella. Yes.
That's right. And then only after we decided to vaccinate the boys, and then we play catch up, and then rubella was kind of like eliminated as a result.
I didn't realize.
Yeah. So we're doing the same mistakes as 1970s.
Well, I mean, but you know, this vaccine is not cheap. So I suppose I would encourage everyone. Even though you have to pay out of pocket, but the advantage is huge.
I mean, we're talking about less than 1,000 ringgit for all three doses, really, isn't it? Yeah, way less than 1,000, I think.
That is, well, for three doses. For all three doses. Said, in the long run, it will play a huge role. Maybe we should get companies to subsidize or maybe even take on some of the cost for the staff.
Yeah, that's true.
They need to get educated first.
Yeah.
That even
we need to do health events and then things like that in order to get make sure that, you know, we get the message out. Because, you know, all these data are quite recent, right? I mean, the licensing... as far as the beyond the sexual naive...
Nice.
I mean, because like for Malaysia, the licensing for women from 26 to 45 is quite recent, isn't that right?
The 26 to 25 was, last year.
Yeah, it's only last year that we have those data emerging.
Inserted, yes.
I think awareness amongst the young girls is quite there, but for the, as you said, the catch-up age... as well as the boys.
And we can talk about your kind of like campaign to do that in various countries.
You're actually working in Sabah to bring about more awareness. So we'll find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasyodi. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist with us. We're talking something very, very female related with Prof. Dr. Jomia Hassan, and consultant obstetrician and gynecologist. Why are you here, George?
Sorry, because I'm learning something here. You know, it's like, seriously, it's one of the most interesting and overwhelming work that, you know, Prof. Jamia is doing, obviously, is the campaign.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke about womb transplants initially, but we sort of digressed to cervical cancer because I always thought that there was a chance that if you lose your uterus because of cervical cancer, there could be a chance of a womb transplant. Is that not the case, Prof.?
I think that's not an ideal patient to do a womb transplant because she's lost the uterus from cervical cancer. She would have been on chemotherapy and there would be other potential complications of that. So it's not an ideal candidate for womb transplant.
Yeah, because presumably the losing the womb and then the complexity of the operation itself to have a transplant is already quite difficult. Yeah. And then when you actually do it in a non-ideal situation, I can imagine that the, you know, success of that will be diminished as a result of that, you know. Yeah. And on top of that, the woman has to be immunosuppressed, right? What sort of impact will that have on the pre-existing cancer?
It depends on what type of cancer she has. But I think in general, that would not be an indication. But let's for discussion sake and say, maybe she lost the uterus from a cancer at a very young age, and otherwise she's healthy. Then maybe there may be a point where we say, could this young girl be given a chance of a uterine transplant? Then we have to look at all other areas, make sure she's feasible and it's safe for them to do and doesn't flare up whatever disease she had before.
I was very curious as to why an IVF is an option only when you have a womb transplant?
Well, because you would want a controlled situation where you would have to prepare the uterus, because I said just now the patient needs to be on drugs, and she, this uterus is not, doesn't belong to her, but she have a normal functioning ovaries. So it'd be better to do an IVF and then transfer it inside. Because if you follow the normal process, allowing the normal sexual intercourse to occur and ovulation and fertilization, it
you
might
just
not
leave too
take.
Many things to chances.
It might not take up. So I suppose they want a controlled situation. It's better in IVF.
And presumably with that, you have a higher chance of success. You want to get the woman pregnant. Mm-hmm. Because according to the protocol, they get after two pregnancies, the two babies have to be born with cesarean section.
Yeah,
and then the womb have to be taken out immediately.
Yes. When do you remove the womb, Professor?
Well, because one, it can be a cause of potential cancer later on.
Right.
And the idea of us putting the wound there in the first place was to give her a chance to have a baby. When you have accomplished that, you don't want to tempt fate that far.
But then we don't remove transplanted kidneys.
No.
That's different.
That's different, yeah.
Transplant kidney, the function is different.
The function is
lifelong.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so, and then for a woman, let's say after having two babies and then still hosting this foreign womb, you have to take immunosuppression for life.
For life.
So, in order to reduce your immunosuppressive therapy, then once a womb is out of your body, then the immunosuppression is no longer required.
Yes. And then will there be impact or risks to the woman after? I mean, it's such a complex process for the poor woman.
Right.
I mean, it's a transplant first, and then you go through a whole load of C-section and everything else, if it's a successful pregnancy, and then another round of general anesthesia to take off the womb,
but,
the transplant.
But that
womb.
The tenacity of women, they are willing to go that length to risk their life to have a child.
It's maternal instinct.
I suppose. So, you know, I know it's complex. It's a lot of potential complication, but there are women out there that are willing to take that risk.
You know, when I read this article, I never even contemplate the layers of complexity until you unravel it layers by layers to say that. And then I begin to wonder, wow, you know, in the modern day science, you know, people will go through all that trouble in order to achieve to see how much we can push the envelope.
I mean, even with IVF, it is a lot of discomfort for the woman, but they go through it.
Yes.
What more womb transplant?
Yes.
You know, so just to come back very quickly before we leave, I wanted to find out more about the work you do in Sabah. What is it actually?
She's very passionate about this.
Sabah is the poorest country in Malaysia.
I'm very passionate. Very passionate about women's health. So, but I also cover the undergraduate medical program in the university. So one of our program is community work, community health, where we expose the medical students to community work. So I get funding from the university and from other people like MAA to go and buy the HPV vaccine. And when we go to the kampung, the villages in Sabah, we've been to, for the last 4 years, I've been to four different villages. We provide them health screening, but we also provide free vaccine for this group of cohort, depending on what kind of funding. And the funding can be like, not to buy free vaccine for this cohort can take 25 to even 40,000. And the universities have been very kind, also some other donors. So we give free vaccine to the children or the catch-up group, and we come back for the second and third doses, not only give them one, but we complete the dose. And we have gone through so many, four villages. But I also do a lot of public awareness around the country under the society, the Obstetrical Gynecological Society, where I have a office gynecology, and when I'm the chairman. So we do meeting courses, and we also do health awareness and articles in the newspaper and so on. The idea is, like what George said just now, I hope that we can eradicate cervical cancer from women.
Especially in Malaysia, presumably.
Especially in Malaysia, because that's still the third cause of death in women in our country. 2014, 2015 still remain number three.
And is it because of the pickup rate for the pap smear is not too optimal in Malaysia?
Yes, our uptake for pap smear is only 40%.
It's government subsidised, isn't it?
Yes, despite whatever. Because women doesn't come forward to do pap smear for many different reasons. They're very shy, they are scared, or they have no time, or they're not so sure. A bit. But most of the time, they're very shy. Our women are very shy to do a pap smear. That's where I think we should drive home the self sampling so that women can do at home and do HPV DNA sampling and if they are negative and we advise them to take vaccine, then they can only, they need to do pap smear cytology maybe once in 5 years.
Okay. So what sort of pickup rate do you have in UK or US, let's say, for example, for pap smear, compared to Malaysia, which is 40%?
Uptake in overseas is much, much higher.
It's about 70, 80%. That's right. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
They're not shy.
So, yeah.
I don't understand it. The more educated and the women have had children, but they are afraid. Many have told me it hurts. I'm like, you've had children. That shouldn't be a problem, you know. That is a million times
more
painful.
But I think it's upbringing, the way culture, our upbringing, religious, you know. The same thing. Not many women, even though they're professional, can talk about sex education.
I know. You're absolutely correct. I have no idea why. When we reproduce, we have no problems. But we can't talk about it to our children. Okay, we just lost that caller. That's all right. So I think we have another question here. Chan, who called us, wanted to know about an embryo transplant.
Yes. You mentioned that. It was recently, one of the BBC articles on embryo transplant something, right?
Yes, about putting in... No, I can't remember
stem
now. What was it again? Yes, using stem cells in... embryo or womb transplants. I can't remember.
We'll look into the details of that. Yeah,
I mean, it completely slipped my mind.
My magical education through Mira's kind of snippet, pickup. So we're going to get the caller to call back if you have another 5 to 7 minutes or so.
Okay, so how would we conclude, Prof. Jamia? Yeah. What is your takeaway message on womb transplants and, you know, HPV, the vaccines? What would you like to take?
I think one is empowerment. Women should take care of their health because nobody else is going to take care about that for them.
Even
their husband. No, so they have to take care
terrible.
Of themselves.
It's like, you know, I was expecting her eyes to kind of look at me and I think, you know, she was like, gosh, even the men don't have to look after the second one.
So we need to empower women to take care about themselves.
Not only we empower ourselves, we have to empower the men to go forward and, you know, get
okay.
some kind
All
of
right. Point
health
taken.
Checks.
That's
you know.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Then I think women should take to do pap smears. And they should take the vaccine, HPV vaccine. And that's one of a powerful way to reduce the risk of cervical cancer, anal cancer, and so on. And, of course, genital warts, depending what kind of vaccines you take. And at the end of the day, if the woman is not healthy, she will not be able to take care of the family unit. Therefore, she is very important to take care of the husband, like George here, and at the same time, take care of the children. And at the same time, a key player to in the workforce.
Absolutely. Just before you leave, I now remember I wanted to ask you about mammograms. There was a recent article that said, you know, we all were encouraged to do mammograms at the age of 40. And then, you know, they said it was 50. And now it says, actually, the later you do the mammogram, the better. And you should do it less frequently. What do we go with, Prof. Jami?
This research keeps coming out
and confusing us. And
Mira, this is why I said to you that when we get Prof. Jami here, we will just home in, take the opportunity, we will ask her all the question. She is the source of all the wisdom.
It's the same with HRT. It's the same with a whole lot of other issues.
So. Well, those are guidelines. No, guidelines, we need to practice within guidelines. Doesn't mean we have to follow verbatim what it says. So what we're saying, if there are high-risk history in that woman, family history of breast cancer and so on, the most important thing that she should do is self-breast examination. Not only her, to all women, they should do self-breast examination every day or at least once a week. When they take a bath, and it's not difficult to do. Now, when you talk about mammogram, we always say in Malaysia, we say if you have a family history, then we do advise you to take mammogram, to do a mammogram maybe after about 40, 45 years old. And now the study in US says you should take it later or more than 50 and every 3 years. Well, I suppose we have to look at the cohort. So at least if you do your mammogram once in 3 years, regardless whether it's about 50 or about 45, we would be able to pick up early signs of breast cancers. So that's the point. I think the point is it doesn't matter which age you are. If you do your own self-examination every day and if there's any suspicion, go and see the doctor. When you hit 50, at least one mammogram every 3 years, I think would be a safe bet.
That's if you have no family history.
Yes.
Okay, family history always...
Then we say 40 years old.
Yeah, I think the best thing is to just go and talk to your doctor.
Yes.
And let them decide the frequency.
Yeah, I mean, kind of bespoke treatment or, you know, monitoring rather than, like you said, guidelines. The guidelines there in order to help you.
Yeah, but then these guidelines tend to scare women. And, you know,
it can
all
be quite
the
confusing as well when it's changed every year.
Yeah, and then you don't want to come forward because, you know, already you're afraid. Oh, what more? The guideline says this, so I don't need to go.
That's right.
You know?
It's misguided.
It is. So your message, George.
Well, two messages. I am in some way, I'm kind of proud that, you know, in medical advancement, we're pushing the envelopes regardless of the complexity of ethical, non-ethical, you know, surgical issues. And then something like this is happening in the UK. I'm expecting to do this trial for 300 patients. And then I am really looking forward to seeing what the results will be like, because I think that will teach us many things about surgery, immunosuppressions, and also, you know, women who are born without womb. I really think I'm quite interested to see the outcome of that.
We'll have Prof. Jamil back.
That's right.
Maybe in a couple of years.
That's right. Okay.
To see how it's
right.
Worked out.
Well, as far as, HPV is concerned, I learned a lot of things about, you know, all the new advancement and also future nanovalent in the horizon.
And that you're never too late to
exactly.
get an HPV vaccine.
And then most importantly, you know, is how inspiring it is to see how passionate you are with women's health and then promoting all these things, especially to the people in the grassroots who really need it in Sabah. I just hope that you go to Kelantan as well at some point.
Inshallah.
She will. Somehow I think she will. Thank you both very much for joining
us
today.
Much.
Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. Jamia Hassan, a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.